And now on RT Radio 1, we are visiting the state of California to hear the story of two Irish engineers, William Mulholland and Michael Morris O'Shaughnessy, who changed the history of that state by bringing water to Los Angeles and San Francisco. A special edition of The History Show with Miles Dungan, this is The Water Boys.
Good evening and welcome to a programme on two Irishmen and the politics of water in California.
Hollis Mulray made this city, and he made me a fortune.
The movement of water from the Owens Valley, which is 250 or so miles north of Los Angeles, is begun in the early 20th century. It's completed in 1913. Mulholland gives his famous line as the water starts trickling down into Los Angeles, and there's an assembly of people looking up at the channel down which is flowing, and he says, "There it is, take it."
Mulholland's story is more dramatic. In conversation with his daughter, Kathleen O'Shaughnessy, someone mentioned Mulholland's achievements, and she said, "Never mention him in association with my father. My father's dams didn't fall down."
The connection between the 1974 movie Chinatown and an Irish water engineer is tenuous, but only because Hollywood, as it does, thoroughly fictionalized the murky tale of how Dubliner William Mulholland brought a fresh supply of water to Los Angeles in the early 20th century. Water that allowed the city to grow at a phenomenal rate, but which also lined the pockets of a group of wealthy and unscrupulous Angelenos. Meanwhile, another Irishman, Michael Morris O'Shaughnessy from Limerick, Californians like to call him O'Shaughnessy, was enabling the growth of the city of San Francisco in like manner. Two ambitious and controversial water projects led by two determined Irish engineers changed the history of the state of California and helped it on its way to becoming the sixth biggest economy in the world.
So California is not unique. It's part of the western half of the United States. And what sets that region apart from the eastern half of the United States is the 100th Meridian that cuts more or less north to south in the center of the United States.
Mark Brilliant is professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, and an expert in the history of California and the American West.
The big defining characteristic of that for the development of the western United States is the availability of rainfall greater than 20 inches. At the time in the 19th century, the assumption was that you needed to have more than 20 inches of rainfall a year to have agriculture without irrigation. West of the 100th Meridian, there is not 20 inches of rain in the vast swath of the American West. In an agricultural country, as the late 19th century America was, how were you going to live in a place that didn't get enough water? And as people were moving westward. And so that's the central predicament.
It's a remarkable thing that California, a state of nearly 40 million people, can exist with giant cities on an arid coast.
Glenn Genzel is professor of history at San Jose State University and an expert in the history of California.
It's in a part of North America where rain falls only in a few months of the year, and then sometimes not at all, subject to droughts. Most of the water in the state of California accumulates in the form of dense snowpack in the Sierra Mountains in the eastern edge of the state, and yet most of the people live on the western edge of the state on the coast. So in order to bring water to where the people are, it's necessary to capture and store and transport the waters of the state from the melting snows in the mountains to the cities on the arid coast. Remarkably, two Irishmen from a very different climate, from a place that's much wetter than California, came to the semi-arid West and were able to solve California's urban water problems. the two main cities of the state, San Francisco and Los Angeles, the two most iconic cities of the state, still rely on water systems designed by these two Irish hydraulic engineers.
What it necessitated was a massive intervention, initially by the federal government. At the state level, there are projects, water projects, and at the city level, especially in places like Los Angeles with the aqueduct, with Mulholland, and in San Francisco under O'Shaughnessy. The idea is that there's no way to live here unless you engage in these huge projects of capturing water, storing water, and moving water, both for irrigation purposes and later for hydroelectric purposes. So that's the central dilemma. In California, the dilemma is further exacerbated by just a cruel twist of geographic fate, which is to say that the main drainage in Southern California out of the Sierra is the San Joaquin River, and it flows out of the Southern Sierra. It flows westward, but as it hits the Central Valley, rather than flowing southward into Southern California, it flows northward, and it meets the main drainage out of the Northern Sierra, the Sacramento River, in the San Francisco Bay Delta area. Compounding that particular problem is the fact that the vast majority of the population in California, I think it's some 70 or 75% of the population, lives in the southern part of the state, while the vast majority of the precipitation, mostly which falls as snow in the Northern Sierra, is in the northern part of the state, something like 75%. So there's just simply no way to live in vast swaths of the West without these major irrigation and reclamation dam building projects.
O'Shaughnessy, on his arrival in San Francisco, worked on a number of mapping projects before opening a private engineering practice in the city. In the early 1900s, he moved briefly to Hawaii, only to return to Northern California after the devastating 1906 San Francisco earthquake.
He's known widely as the man who brought water from the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, built the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, dammed the beautiful valley, and brought water to the city of San Francisco and the surrounding regions.
Anthony Booker is the president of the San Francisco Irish Literary and Historical Society.
If you look at his career in its entirety as a city engineer, he was really a man primarily responsible in the recovery after the 06 earthquake for building the basic infrastructure of the city in its expansion from the enclave that had been built post-Gold Rush era and the industrialization. But the city had plenty of room to expand in the sand dunes and mountains to the west of the central city. He built tunnels. He built roads. He built the municipal transportation network. And San Francisco, in 12 or 13, established the first municipally owned, not privately owned, but municipally owned transportation system, the municipal railway. And so he's essentially the father of what we call Muni in San Francisco. He built the Twin Peaks Tunnel, the DuBose Tunnel, and the Stockton Tunnel as well. And what's interesting is not only his technical sort of virtuosity, but also his commitment to efficiency and freedom from political interference and corruption. So it's all of these things, I think, that have to be taken as a package, if you will, in understanding his contributions.
O'Shaughnessy didn't invent the whole project. The previous engineer, Marsden Manson was his name, had worked on that, on the early plans. But there were many, many details to be worked out, and the whole thing had to be built. So O'Shaughnessy started with the dam that would basically ruin the second most beautiful valley in the entire Sierra Nevada, the Hetch Hetchy Valley, second only to Yosemite Valley itself, and create a great big bathtub for the people of San Francisco. So work crews and equipment, steam shovels were brought up there in the mountains, and work began. The dam was finished in 1923. We just reached the centennial. It's still known today as O'Shaughnessy Dam, named after the engineer who designed and built it. And it's still standing, still doing its job. And later it was raised even higher to create a larger reservoir as the city needed more water than originally planned. And the dam was so well designed that it was able to increase capacity with no problem. O'Shaughnessy came up with the brilliant scheme to install hydroelectric generating facilities as the water moved downhill by gravity to generate free electricity, essentially. that then the city of San Francisco could sell to private utilities companies in order to finance the further construction of the aqueduct. And in this way, the cost of the project was considerably minimized. But the whole thing took a dozen years and more, and required several votes of the people of San Francisco to approve the municipal bonds to pay for the project. As it went on year after year with elaborate power systems and aqueducts and pumps and transportation of water and distribution systems, and finally the massive purchase of the entire Spring Valley water system that had to be bought at a high price from the private company that was being supplanted by the civic water system. When the voters were asked to pay for all of that through the 1920s and early 30s, people started to complain that the MM initials of Michael Morris O'Shaughnessy's name really stood for more money, because it seemed like he was constantly asking for more.
There was considerable, obviously, opposition, because this was coincident with the time when the park was established, when the great naturalist, Scottish-born John Muir, waxed lyrical about the great beauty of the of Yosemite Park, introduced it to President Teddy Roosevelt, who had sort of an epiphany, wonderful experience, viewing Yosemite Valley through a light dusting of snow. So it was, you know, one of the world's, it's a great natural cathedral, Yosemite Valley was, and the park itself was this incredible jewel, and not widely known to the public. So naturalist John Muir obviously made the park well known to the public as their endowment, and he loved Hetch Hetchy Valley also. The Hetch Hetchy Valley was, according to legend and contemporary accounts, almost as beautiful and almost as spectacular as Yosemite Valley itself. And so he was dead set against and led the opposition to the inundation of the treasures of the Hetch Hetchy Valley.
Sad to say, this most precious and sublime feature of the Yosemite National Park, one of the greatest of all our natural resources for the uplifting joy and peace and health of the people, is in danger of being dammed and made into a reservoir to help supply San Francisco with water and light. This will flood it from wall to wall and bury its gardens and groves 100 or 200 feet deep. This grossly destructive commercial scheme has long been planned and urged, even though water as pure and abundant can be got from sources outside of the People's Park in a dozen different places. All this because of the comparative cheapness of both the dam and the territory. This diverts from the great uses to which it was dedicated in the Act of 1890, establishing the Yosemite National Park. That anyone would try to destroy Hetch Hetchy Valley seems incredible, but sad experience shows that there are people good enough and bad enough for anything. The proponents of the dam scheme bring forward a lot of bad arguments to prove that the only righteous thing to do with the people's parks is to destroy them bit by bit as they are able. Their arguments are curiously like those of the devil, devised for the destruction of the first garden. These temple destroyers, devotees of ravaging commercialism, seem to have a perfect contempt for nature, and instead of lifting their eyes to the God of the mountains, they lift them to the almighty dollar. Damn Hetch Hetchy! One might as well damn for water tanks the people's cathedrals and churches, for no holier temple has ever been consecrated by the heart of man.
He hated the idea that San Francisco would be allowed to desecrate a national park in order to obtain a water supply for people on the other side of the state. But in 1913, a year after O'Shaughnessy became city engineer, Congress passed the Raker Act, which finally granted San Francisco permission to build a dam in the Hetch Hetchy Valley, dam up the Tuolumne River that flows through that valley, and thereby create a massive reservoir that would store waters for the people of San Francisco. This was the major legal victory that San Francisco had been fighting for. The nature lovers were vanquished. The city proceeded with their epic project, and O'Shaughnessy was in charge.
In total, the project consisted of the dam, of course, and then a 156-mile aqueduct including 85 miles of tunnels, which conveyed water from the Sierra Nevada mountains and the Tuolumne River all the way to San Francisco entirely by gravity. So my understanding is they were pumping some pumping stations down at the bay level, but essentially all that water is conveyed all the way to the San Francisco Bay by gravity. In its own right, it's an astonishing feat of engineering and something that governments today would be really hard-pressed to do for cost alone, if not many other regulatory reasons, but nearly impossible to do today.
New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles are constantly expanding their water systems. New York's needs increase at the rate of 30 million gallons per day. Los Angeles increased at the rate of 10 million. So it was splendid foresight to anticipate our own needs to the extent of 400 million gallons daily. This will save the San Francisco of the future from entangling and annoying conflicts in securing and developing additional water sources. San Francisco is living a hand-to-mouth existence in its water distribution. The reservoirs within the city, if kept completely filled, hold less than 3 days' supply. The inadequacy of the shortage was forcibly shown in the 1906 earthquake, for pipelines leading to the city were broken by the quick shock. The lesson is evident. Just as the nation entered the World War, absolutely unprepared in 1917, so we encountered the disaster of 1906 without adequate preparation. An earthquake of the same intensity at the present time might cause equally dire results.
O'Shaughnessy was known to be, as they said, never voluble. His views lived through his work. However, occasionally you'd see sort of his personal views would leak out. One thing he said with pride was that upon the completion of the water project was that not a crooked finger has been able to chisel a dollar out of it. And that's saying a lot. Now, he had a lot of dollars at his disposal because he was always going to the public with new bond issues to finance his projects. But they were well served by his technical prowess, but also his dedication to efficiency and freedom from corruption. So he enjoyed the support, actually, of the political support of Mayor Rolfe and then succeeding mayors up through 1932. But as is, I guess, the nature of things, he did acquire some enemies, of course, in the process of being effective and free of corruption. And in the course of events, found that he was shunted aside at the very end of his career from 1932 under the administration of Mayor Angelo Rossi.
Tragically, O'Shaughnessy didn't live to see the water of Hetch Hetchy reach the taps of San Francisco. He designed and built the whole thing and saw it through to the end, but he retired shortly before it was complete and then died just 2 weeks before the first water flowed through the aqueduct. That was a terrible shame, but his name lives on the dam. That's the mainstay of the whole project.
How was he remembered in San Francisco?
Fondly. He has a good reputation in the city, at least among those who appreciate the permanency and reliability and efficiency of the works that he left behind. Not just the dam that bears his name and the Hetch Hetchy project I've been talking about, but remember, he laid out the streetcar lines of the city that still bear the same alphabetical letter designations that he designed, that were his idea. And the tunnels that he decreed should be dug through the famous hills of San Francisco for the streetcar lines to be more efficient in their transit around the city. That was his idea, and those tunnels are all still there. So there is much talk these days of somehow restoring Hetch Hetchy Valley and lowering O'Shaughnessy Dam, but I don't think anybody holds that against him personally.
Welcome to the Hetch Hetchy Valley. This was a favorite spot of John Muir's. He called it one of nature's most precious mountain temples. 100 years ago, he led the fight for its preservation. But even though it was within Yosemite National Park, this magnificent valley was lost, dammed, and flooded under 300 feet of water.
Indiana Jones himself, a.k.a. Harrison Ford, throwing his weight behind the current campaign to dismantle the O'Shaughnessy Dam. The controversy over the drowning of Hetch Hetchy is as lively today as it was when John Muir's voice was the loudest in condemning the Irish engineer's signature project.
Today, the people of California are considering the idea of restoring Hetch Hetchy to its original beauty. Recently, the state published a report which concluded that Hetch Hetchy can be restored without anyone losing water or power. This is a practical idea whose time has come. We now have an amazing opportunity to return this national treasure to the American people.
For multi-generational San Franciscans such as myself, the Hetch Hetchy is part of the DNA code of San Francisco. It is one of the foundations upon which the greatness of this city rests. That to comprehend disestablishing it, tearing it down, going somewhere else, is almost to think the unthinkable.
The late Kevin Starr, preeminent historian of the state of California, nailing his colors to the mast on a PBS documentary on the issue of the restoration of the Hetch Hetchy Valley. Starr sees O'Shaughnessy's project as one of the triumphs of the progressive era in American politics in the early decades of the 20th century.
The Hetch Hetchy comes out of a larger movement in America in which this country in the early 20th century laid down the infrastructure of modern America. The progressives, while not overtly religious, had a sense that public works represented the highest ethical governmental activity possible on the part of concerned citizens. To lay down the public works infrastructure for what they envisioned as a great civilization that would rise up here on the shores of San Francisco Bay.
The idea has obviously great merit because this is, by all accounts, one of the most beautiful places in the mountains, if not California as a whole, the Hetch Hetchy Valley. I guess the argument could be made that there are other ways of getting your water and power. It generates a lot of power, of course. It's waxed and waned over the years, but there have been movements to dismantle the dam. But I think what you'll find consistently with the mayors of San Francisco, from Mayor Willie Brown, Mayor Ed Lee, current Mayor Lyndon Breed, and the people who run the Public Utilities Commission, I interviewed, for instance, Ed Harrington, who has ran the Public Utilities Commission for many years. They're adamantly opposed to meddling with the system as it is.
A time may come when the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir is abandoned, but even if that does happen, it would take generations to restore the drowned valley to its former beauty. John Muir knew that he had lost the battle to save Hetch Hetchy a year before his death in 1914. He could be forgiven, however, were he to take some post-mortem satisfaction in the fact that his Irish nemesis, Michael Morris O'Shaughnessy, never got to see the fulfilment of his enterprise.
The family was a bit embittered by his treatment at the end of his career because they felt that he was not recognized for the scale and scope of his accomplishments. There is O'Shaughnessy Boulevard in the central San Francisco, and two actually beautiful busts were created by an Irish artist and were placed in 2002. One is at the dam site in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. The other is in City Hall in San Francisco. So he is well recognized by the people who run things in the city.
Coming up after the break, how William Mulholland defied the odds and brought water to Los Angeles, but became mired in controversy and tragedy. Welcome back to our program marking the achievements of two famous Irish-born Californians who brought water to the state's most important cities. Unlike his Northern Californian contemporary, Los Angeles Water Department Superintendent William Mulholland did not have the benefit of a college education before he left Ireland as a teenager, although he did receive a basic secondary schooling from the Christian Brothers in O'Connell Schools.
Mulholland, who had become a self-taught hydraulic engineer, he'd come to Northern California. I think he arrived somewhere around 1877. He was maybe in his early 20s at the time, made his way by horseback from San Francisco down to LA, started working at a private water company. A lot of the water projects in San Francisco and in LA and in other places were these private for-profit ventures that struggled. That's part of why the government ultimately realized it needed to step in.
This is when Los Angeles really started booming after 1886, the real estate boom, tourist boom, the boom in health resorts as people discovered Southern California climate as a possible cure for many ailments of the day. The population of the city doubled or tripled every 10 years for a long time after he took over. So you can imagine what it was like for Mulholland scrambling to find more and more water for the fast-growing city. It got to the point where people had to buy water from pushcart peddlers who sold it by the pitcherful, and families were sharing their bath water once a week. So in 1904, he sent a very scary report to the city council saying that the city was essentially out of water and could not continue growing unless it found more.
Now, at this point, Mulholland would have been the chief engineer of the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, which is a very appropriate way to bill it, because water is power. That's the whole central point of the movie Chinatown, and water and power are inextricably bound in the Western United States. People in the Owens Valley were told that if they gave up their water rights, they would be getting an irrigation and reclamation project there.
Mulholland was lucky that the former mayor, Fred Eaton, who was a friend of his, had already devised a scheme for tapping a far-off water supply from the Owens Valley, which was over 200 miles away from the city of Los Angeles. So Fred Eaton decided to bring Bill Mulholland with him to the Owens Valley to see for himself the scheme that Eaton first envisioned. Mulholland's granddaughter later described their journey as two sots on a spree, because they supposedly left a trail of empty whiskey bottles behind them as they rode off over 200 miles through the deserts of southeastern California, some of the most barren, desolate terrain in North America, in order to reach the Owens Valley. This is a remote, high-altitude valley in the southern Sierra that is arid and doesn't get rainfall, but it's watered by the Owens River that flows through it with fresh snowmelt from the high mountains that are all around it. The Paiute Indians had lived there for thousands of years, and in the late 19th century, American settlers had started filling up the Owens Valley, claiming land, you know, homesteading and obtaining land grants from the government. They were building up a prosperous farming and ranching community based on irrigating with the waters of the Owens River. So towns were growing, farms and ranches were prospering, and this is when Eaton and Mulholland showed up and began sizing up the Owens River and devising plans to basically hijack it away from the people who lived around it and used it productively for their own livelihoods, and instead take it to transport over 200 miles away to serve the needs of fast-growing Los Angeles.
And there was a lot of pressure to build water because the two railroad lines had made their way into Los Angeles, the Santa Fe Railroad line coming from east to west into Southern California. And then you had the Central Pacific, which then had the spur of the Southern Pacific Railroad, which was reaching Los Angeles. And both of those get there in the late 1880s. The agriculture prior to that time had been less labor intensive because it was wheat, large scale wheat farms. But now the possibility of turning to citrus was emerging, especially when the refrigerated railroad cars emerge. And citrus is more water intensive than wheat. And so now you have the populations coming as a result of the railroads. You have the interest in citrus that's exacerbated or raised by the fact that you have railroad cars that can ship citrus to the main population centers to the east and across the Atlantic Ocean as well. Unless there is some way to move water, you have just one main drainage in L.A., the L.A. River, which would flood during the wet season and run to the sea and be dry for most of the time of the year. That's not concretized until, I think, the 1940s, but it's a small percentage of the water that L.A. ends up using. So you'll have to come up with, if you're going to have a large population in L.A., you have to figure out how to move water.
Mulholland decided that Eaton's plan would work, and that's when he started working on hoodwinking the farmers and ranchers of the Owens Valley into selling away their livelihoods without knowing it. He sent agents, especially a guy named J.B. Lippincott, to the Owens Valley to pose as agents of the federal government's Bureau of Reclamation, which commonly would spend federal dollars to build elaborate irrigation works to benefit local farmers and ranchers. So Lippincott and his men more or less pretended to be Bureau of Reclamation agents while they made the rounds of all the farmers and ranchers in the valley and convinced them to sign away their water rights in order to serve what they thought was going to be a federal project to their benefit. Only later did they learn that these men to whom they'd signed away water rights were actually working for the city of Los Angeles. The news came out in 1905 when the Los Angeles Times newspaper couldn't restrain itself and finally revealed what was going on. You can imagine the outrage for the farmers and ranchers who'd sold at a low price, assuming that the project was going to help them.
Having essentially cheated the people of the Owens Valley out of their water, Mulholland still had to get the liquid gold more than 240 miles south to Los Angeles. This daunting task was achieved by the building of the impressive Los Angeles Aqueduct between 1908 and 1913 at a cost of $23 million. That's close to $1 billion today. The water was piped across the mountains and deserts of East Central California.
Mulholland, being a self-taught engineer of not the greatest sophistication, was able to envision this massive project as a very simple design. Because the Owens Valley is at a high altitude and Los Angeles, the city, is down at sea level, the whole thing could be built as a giant gravity siphon, sort of like a garden hose, where it could go downhill and uphill on the way to Los Angeles because of the effects of gravity. So in 1905, the people of Los Angeles voted in favor of funding the project, and construction began soon afterwards.
It was the largest engineering project since the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, which is remarkable to think that it was not a federal project, right? It was done by a municipality. It was funded through bond issues in the early 20th century in L.A., and Mulholland was the one supervising that entire process.
Thousands of men were hired to head out into the remote deserts of southeastern California, where temperatures would soar over 40 degrees centigrade in the daytime and below freezing at night. Thousands of mules and giant steam shovels and all kinds of equipment had to be transported, and huge steel tubes that were forged in Germany were shipped all the way around South America and brought to Los Angeles for this project. Mulholland worked himself into exhaustion, but the project was delivered on time and under budget when it was finished in 1913.
The drawing of water from the Owens Valley was not a zero-sum game. There were winners and losers. The big winner was the city of Los Angeles, whose population had rocketed to over 500,000 by 1920, outstripping San Francisco. The enraged losers were located in the Owens Valley and were not inclined to give up their water without a fight.
As the project was completed and began operating and taking the water from the Owens River, it pretty much took the whole thing. The city of Los Angeles was growing faster than ever, and it was necessary to take more water than originally planned. By the 1920s, there was no water left for the Owens Valley communities that had relied on that river for a generation. So their crops dried up, their citrus orchards died, their cattle could no longer graze, and the livelihood of many thousands of townspeople was severely threatened. So at that point, mysteriously, portions of the Los Angeles Aqueduct were blown up in the middle of the night. I mean, it started on a smaller scale where people would just sort of turn off the sluice gates and run away. Eventually, it turned to violence. And on more than one occasion, dynamite was used to destroy portions of the Los Angeles Aqueduct, at least temporarily return the waters to the people of the valley. Mulholland was furious. How could these people dare to mess with his handiwork? Mulholland's granddaughter said it must have been like slashing the Mona Lisa right in front of Leonardo. Mulholland sent armed policemen from Los Angeles with machine guns to guard the aqueduct. He famously declared that he regretted now that there were not enough trees left in the Owens Valley to hang all the ranchers there who deserved it.
Film Chinatown, the Los Angeles private detective, Jake Gittes, played by Jack Nicholson, finds himself investigating a conspiracy to profit from a Mulholland-like water scheme. Chinatown, although it deviates significantly from fact, has a solid historical basis nonetheless. It roughly parallels the story of how some of the wealthiest citizens of Los Angeles found a way of becoming even wealthier by exploiting Mulholland's scheme. In Robert Towne's Oscar-winning Chinatown screenplay, the prime mover in the corrupt conspiracy of L.A. millionaires is the fictional Noah Cross, played by an imperious John Huston, who offers the often floundering detective a pithy lesson in realpolitik.
Going to be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not going to get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gitts, either you bring the water to L.A., or you bring L.A. to the water.
How are you going to do that?
By incorporating the valley into the city. Simple as that.
When Mulholland was buying up water rights, the project was still in secrecy, but the members of the Los Angeles Board of Water Commissioners were certainly aware of it because they were authorizing and paying for everything. Well, one member of that Board of Water Commissioners was also a member of a land investment syndicate. And it's pretty clear that Moses Sherman was his name, was certainly involved in sharing information about the upcoming water project that was secretly being planned, and sharing that information with his fellow investors, who included some of the richest men in Los Angeles, Harrison Gray Otis and Henry Huntington and Harry Chandler. So they were able to use their inside knowledge to buy up arid ranch land on the outskirts of Los Angeles, in the area where the water of the aqueduct would have to be brought and delivered. And it was going to flow underground at that point to build up the aquifer of the San Fernando Valley. With that inside knowledge, these investors were able to buy up dry ranch land that was not worth very much from ranchers who were eager to dump their unproductive lands. They bought the stuff at very low prices. But later, when the aqueduct was revealed and built and brought water to that valley, suddenly it became an extremely productive piece of farmland, not just for farming, but for orchards and growing oranges by the thousands of acres. This became some of the most productive farmland in America in terms of the value of crops, dollars per acre. So the investors profited enormously, and then even more so as those citrus orchards were then later subdivided and sold off as homes. And the San Fernando Valley today houses millions of people. The hardest part was that they had to bring the borders of Los Angeles out to where the water was arriving. So they also arranged for Los Angeles to expand and annex the San Fernando Valley. It was a sordid tale of inside information being used to the private benefit of investors who knew about a public project before anyone else. And the best thing we can say about that is Bill Mulholland himself appears not to have been involved.
How much are you worth?
I have no idea. How much do you want?
No, I just want to know what you're worth. Over 10 million?
Oh, my, yes.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitts. The future.
In a very twisted and kind of Baudelaireized version, this is sort of the idea behind the Roman Polanski film from 1974 called Chinatown, with the script by Robert Towne, who's from Los Angeles and is very aware of this whole story. town moved the story further in time ahead to the 1930s. It actually happened in the early 1900s and changed a lot of details in all the names. But you kind of get a gist of the behind-the-scenes chicanery involved.
Unlike O'Shaughnessy, William Mulholland was able to bring his signature project to fruition in his own lifetime. But for the self-made Irish engineer, his triumphant completion of the Los Angeles Aqueduct was as good as it got.
He's clearly alluded to in Chinatown as the Hollis Mulray character in the movie. His life doesn't end as a result of a murder. His life ends as a result of having certified in 1927 that the St. Francis Dam is safe, only to have it the next day come tumbling down. It was a water storage in the L.A. area to capture some of this water that was flowing from the project that he had helped build, and he resigned.
Mulholland began to plan and build a chain of reservoirs near the city of Los Angeles that could store Owens River waters for times when drought or perhaps explosions had interrupted the flow. The biggest one of all was in San Francisco Canyon, which is northwest of Los Angeles. Here, Mulholland designed and built a simple dam, but a big one, called the St. Francis Dam, completed in the mid-1920s, when Los Angeles was topping a million people in population and water was becoming, again, a major issue. The reservoir behind the St. Francis Dam was filled to capacity because Mulholland needed every drop he could get. And one day in March of 1928, the St. Francis Dam cracked and began to leak. The massive concrete structure had some fissures in it, and water was pouring out. So Mulholland, the great engineer who designed the thing, was summoned to inspect the dam. And he spent a day there looking it over, and he pronounced it safe. He told the local watchman to plug up the fissures with oakum, and he went home and went to bed. Well, that very night, the St. Francis Dam broke apart and collapsed from flaws in its original design and the weight of the waters behind it. Mulholland had chosen an unstable dam site and had not anchored the edges of his dam deep enough into the surrounding canyon walls. So on March 12, 1928, in the middle of the night, the St. Francis Dam gave way on both sides. It was a disaster. Over 12 billion gallons of water burst forth in a violent, rampaging flood that obliterated farms, orchards, whole towns, and homesteads in rural Ventura County. The water didn't flow into the city of Los Angeles from there. It flowed to the sea through a mostly rural area.
They called us and told us that the dam had broken. And everybody came over to our house. And they were all sitting there discussing, well, it cannot be possible. It's only been completed for about a week. No way. And so the men said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go out and drive up along the river and see if we see any water coming. And Dad said they stepped outside and they could hear it coming.
And our nearest neighbor, who was half a mile away, came up, woke us up, told us what was going on, and all four of us, mother, dad, my sister, and myself, went out and listened in the middle of the road, just listened to the roar.
Mulholland himself had to appear at the coroner's inquest for over 430 dead people, and there was talk of indicting him for murder at that point. The man was 73 years old, and still in charge of the entire water system of Los Angeles, but now it was clear he was done. He was over. He said that he regretted what had happened, and he was willing to take the blame, but he didn't say much more about that. Rather than indict him for murder, the city simply allowed him to retire. He lived on only a few more years as a kind of bitter recluse, and his granddaughter recalled that his retirement home needed an armed guard 24 hours a day because they were worried about Owens Valley ranchers or Ventura County victims of the St. Francis disaster who might come looking for him to seek vengeance. The city that once worshipped him as its savior, that would have elected a mayor if he had wanted the job, now ignored him. ¶¶
I think Mulholland Drive is a symbol of how important he is, right? One of these central sort of thoroughfares through the Hollywood Hills. You can look on either side of Mulholland Drive and you can see the world that Mulholland created in Los Angeles.
Mulholland Drive up in the hills above Los Angeles is where people go to bring their dates to make out in the car and look down on the city at night. That's how he lives on in Los Angeles today.
If it wasn't him, maybe it would have been some other water and power engineer. Someone needed to solve the problem of how to get LA its water, how to slake LA's thirst. It was him that did it, that really sort of spearheaded the project. And it's impossible to conceive of Los Angeles without William Mulholland.
That's it from The History Show for this week. The program is a Pegasus production for RTE Radio. For me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
On Twitter at RTE History Show.